Before introducing the speaker, I have one or two things I must mention. The first is that following the lecture, there will be a coffee and tea reception in the main lobby here, to which everyone is invited. And we hope that many of you will be able to take the time to stay and talk. The other item that must be touched on is the matter of membership in this worthy endeavor. The costs, the expenses are, it's a frugal organization, but there are expenses, there are costs, and we depend upon memberships largely to defray those. So as most of you have heard before, it's now $30 for a family, $20 for single, and $10 for a student. And there will be people out in the lobby who will be prepared to sign you up and take your money, your check, or your promise if you see fit to do that. And as I'm told, it is tax deductible. It's my great pleasure then to introduce to you Darrell Duke, who needs not very much introduction to most people in this part of the world. Mr. Duke was born in Vancouver and was educated here, graduated from this university, and has continued essentially to reside in Vancouver, although his travels and endeavors have taken him to many parts of the world over the last 40 to 50 years. He has been very active as a director, producer, and writer over that time, has been the recipient of Emmy Awards, Christopher Award, National Society of Film Critics Special Award, and various other awards, those in relation to his endeavors as a filmmaker. In the United States, he's worked for all of the major networks there and for many of the major studios in Hollywood. His career has taken him to Europe, the Middle East, South America, and Asia. In this country, he has written, produced, and directed films for the CBC, the National Film Board, and was a founder, chairman, and chief executive officer of the independent Vancouver station, CKVU-TV. As an essayist and journalist, he has done extensive writing for newspapers and magazines, the Globe and Mail, Canadian Forum, the Georgia Strait, the Vancouver Sun, and good many others. In 1997, he was inducted into Star Walk and the BC Entertainment Hall of Fame at a ceremony in Vancouver at the Orpheum Theater. And just last year, he was the first recipient of the Outstanding Achievement Award for an individual given at the Columbia Film Industry Annual Lee Awards Ceremony. That's by no means a complete list of his achievements and experience, but I know you're not here to hear me tell you about that. I will now call upon Mr. Duke to address you.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, Bill, for that very gracious introduction. And I think you picked up my notes along with my bio. Which either is a heart starter or a heart stopper. I don't know which, but and either it caps the very gracious introduction that you gave, or it undermines it totally. I'm not sure. But it is very nice to be here at the Vancouver Institute. I'm very conscious that over the years I've heard of the terrific array of speakers that have come to this forum, and I am very pleased and honored to be among their company and with you tonight. And I'm very also pleased to talk about the media, a subject that I've spent my adult life being both interested and occupied in. But first, also by way of welcome, and I find it both auspicious and appropriate that we're here tonight on the first night of Chinese New Year. So may I, in Mandarin, wish you Gong Xi Fa Chai, Happy New Year to all of you. And it is thrilling to be also back on the UBC campus, because it was, as Bill suggested, 50 years ago that I was getting ready to write my final exams and head off into what I guess every graduate, undergraduate knows is a very uncertain world. And when I review those 50 years, and I think back to the programs and film shoots and other things I've been called on to do, I kind of have to stop a moment and I think, well, I've been called on to drink too much White Horse Scotch with President Tito of Yugoslavia, and I've had to book Rosie the Bowling Chimpanzee for a TV talk show, and I've been hit with a custard pie by Soupy Sales in New York on the full ABC network, and I had to do, which I don't know whether it was a capper or not, but I had to do a long-filmed interview in San Francisco with Carol Doda, who was the first topless dancer to gain notoriety by augmenting her already ample figure with silicone. So I do wonder, with this invitation, whether my take on the media is sufficiently profound for the deliberations of this institution. But the years do bring a perspective and a knowledge of the hills and valleys, of the shows that worked, the ideas that didn't, the people who should have been rewarded and weren't, and those who have been rewarded far too much and are still around taking the oxygen from our atmosphere. And would that life in the media were all balloons and belly dancers, but I assure you it's not. None of us who are writers, directors, or producers who deal in ideas and TV stations ever get off the ice without receiving some very serious body checks. And some of those I want to talk to you about tonight, and some of them I want to put to one side. But certainly for any creative person in the broadcast media in Canada today, in TV production or film, there is very much a darker side. We are in possession of a broadcast system, and that's what I'm really talking about, not the individual shows or very fine award-winning films like The Red Violin and Sunshine, which won a Genie the other night. But we are in a possession of a broadcast system, both public and private, which despite all the protestations of vast consumer choice, has actually all but eliminated choice. We have in Canada a system that is thinly budgeted, heavily controlled, almost totally commercial, centralized in its mind and management, thousands of miles from these shores of ours, and perhaps most distressingly of all, we have a media system that is not at all representative of the multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilingual society that is today what we call English Canada. Despite all the studios, the cable systems, satellites in the sky, all the government regulations, the panels of lawyers and tax accountants, despite the investments of billions in hardware, despite crews and camera gear, we have scattered from coast to coast, we've developed somehow a media system whose hallmarks, I regret to say at this point, I can only find filled with censorship, racism, and a stultifying lack of innovation. Tonight, I want to do a journey back and forth through some of my 50 years in what is now called the media. But more importantly, I want to talk about some of the concepts I see affecting us today and perhaps into our future as a country. There is, to my mind, an urgent need to redefine our broadcast media so that they reflect the Canada that is out there. I see the need to redefine the very word content, for that's a thing as we watch show by show we don't really think about, but all those are finite human decisions and they come down to what I call content. But to redefine that very word content so that we can benefit as viewers and as citizens in the rich subject matter that we are missing, and missing in such a severe way that it belittles our lives and our nation, and particularly, and I think that's my main point tonight here, is that it belittles our life in Vancouver as Vancouver residents and citizens. I want to talk about control, program control, as exerted by a neatly interlocking system of government appointments and the concentration of ownership, which has placed our broadcast assets in just a few corporate hands. For it is this interlocking system that has stripped from us the programming that would truly strike sparks in our spirits. I want to talk about censorship and how the nature of censorship has changed from acts of government to the actions of private corporate power and those acting under contract law rather than under acts of parliament. And of course, I want to talk about our public broadcaster, the CBC, and how it has been undermined by government and how the CBC, our own network and yours, has betrayed us, not by knowing who, by knowing not who we Canadians really are in all our diversity. Now, talk about the media can get very abstract, and I hope during the question period that follows these remarks, you'll help me emerge from any thickets of gobbledygook and verbiage that I might have fallen into. So I look forward to your questions later and also continuing to kind of refine some of the things that I'm raising with you. But first, I want to go back to that time that I mentioned 50 years ago when I left UBC. My path took me immediately east to Ottawa and then into documentary film production at the National Film Board of Canada. I was lucky to leave UBC armed with two compelling concepts. They were ideas that fueled my work for years to come. Perhaps they still reside within me and motivate the things I do, particularly here in Canada. One was symbolized by Canadian journalist Bruce Hutchison's well-known book of those years. It was a book about Canada, and it was called The Unknown Country. An unknown Canada truly was in 1950. The 30s had been the decade of the Depression, the 40s the decade of war and war's aftermath. Canada was a poor country, the distances were enormous, the emptiness profound. There were no jet planes. Train travel was slow and usually uncomfortable. The roads across the country were unpaved, and some of you may remember the term washboard for those endless miles of bumpy gravel on the two-lane road of what was grandly called the Trans-Canada Highway. There was no television, just the occasional Canadian news story tucked into a Paramount or Movietone newsreel in the American-owned movie theaters of our country. If there was ever a motivation, however, to take out a movie camera, it was provided by Hutchison's book and the thought of trying as a young person to begin to fill in the blanks of this magnificent unknown country, which certainly was prompted by Hutchison and prompted by the country that was out there. My UBC friends and I, who had been born and raised here in BC, had no idea what Canada looked like. Canada, for me, comprised the lonely inlets and the rain-swept beaches of the BC coast. My family had come to BC first from England in the late 1860s and then had moved on from Ontario in the late 1890s. None of them ever made a return trip back to eastern Canada, not even to see distant relatives or old-time friends. I watched as a child as contacts with the east, Ontario, dwindled away to a few Christmas cards or to an occasional letter containing a frayed obituary from a Belleville, Ontario paper. I only realized in thinking about this talk tonight that I must have been the first of the family to go east in 50 years. When I sat up on the train on my way to the film board for 4 days and 3 nights and arrived for the first time in Toronto in the summer of 1950, I was astonished to discover that people in Ontario used the same money we did in BC. Now, the second concept grew out of my early interest in film. I had picked up from reading about the birth of the British documentary movement and from viewing here at the UBC Film Society some of the well-known films this movement had produced, films such as Night Mail and Listen to Britain. John Grierson, a crusty, brilliant Scotsman, often called the father of the documentary film, had also been the father of our National Film Board. He had come to Canada at the beginning of the war to found the NFB. Grierson's thought about documentary film making was simply expressed, but it was profound in its meaning. Grierson had written, and I quote, "Through information, a society is made better." To work to Grierson's blunt and extraordinarily simple doctrine was a badge of honor. I certainly knew, as did many of my colleagues, that Grierson's precept differentiated us from the commercial entertainment of the Americans. Grierson's dictum meant that in Canada, our work had a social purpose. Whether we worked in drama, music, or documentary, we knew because of Grierson's example that we each worked not just for ourselves and our personal careers and egos, but for the Canadian people. Now, I'm aware that in today's context, this is pretty heady stuff, but it was what for a very long time gave a different and proud cast to Canadian programming. I went from the Canadian Film Board to public broadcasting in the CBC when it went on the air in December 1953 here in Vancouver. In 1958, I moved to CBC Television in Toronto, and I produced programs which some of you may remember, public affairs series like Close Up and Explorations and This Hour Has 7 Days, and also the drama series Quest, Wojcik and Quentin Durgan's. For those of us at the CBC, Grierson's admonition still pertained even into those crazy years of the 60s. Through information, a society is made better. After those years, as Bill said kindly in his introduction, I moved to the States and I produced shows for many U.S. networks and studios. But by means of film assignments in Europe and Asia and the Middle East and South America, I confronted a wide range of television. I watched the TV output of state-controlled media in China when I worked there for a year on Taipan. I saw the programming of Suharto's army, in Indonesia, where TV channels, seemingly free and market-driven, were totally dominated by government design with little other than game shows and music videos. And in Myanmar, where that country's repressive regime saw to it that the news was but a careful selection of army generals attending conferences or assembled with all their medals to give out awards at high school sports days, and where foreign news was limited to such controversial and informative items as Queen Elizabeth attending a horse show. Of course, I saw Europe many times, but by the 80s and 90s, I witnessed the increasing elimination of national cultures on television in countries such as Italy and Switzerland and Austria, France and Holland, as the TV screens of Europe were inundated with the output of Rupert Murdoch's Fox and Sky networks, and where U.S. imports of Oprah Winfrey and reruns of Dallas and Dynasty came to dominate local programming. But I feel I was very lucky. I feel in all those wanderings from country to country, and from assignment to assignment, I was able to get a view of just how easily controlled TV can be, how quickly it can cease to mirror the lives of people, the issues on the streets, or the concerns of a country's academics, artists, and intellectuals. Because I traveled from country to country, I could make notes and compare different systems. I had, as they say, the precious gift of knowledge. And often I could see that whole populations were being conned and lied to. I could see that people might know what they saw on TV, they just didn't know what they didn't see. All the while, however, as I went about my career, I became wrapped up in projects which took my attention for months at a time and took me away to live elsewhere. But I always felt that things back home were okay. I thought the system in Canada was well-intentioned and benign, that Canadian citizens were getting the television they wanted, they deserved, and they needed. I thought in those years the Canadian citizen was protected, that informational and cultural rights in this country were being observed. I thought the CBC worked in the public interest. I thought that broadcast regulations and oversight of TV ownership by government agencies such as the CRTC kept the ambitions of the private broadcasters in check, that such regulation and oversight made them a responsible part of an overall single Canadian system, both public and private. I thought private broadcasters had a high regard for the public trust they were given when granted their licenses to broadcast, and that they knew the airwaves belonged not to them, but to the Canadian people. How wrong I was, and how naive. Very quickly after returning to launch the company and the application to the CRTC, which gave birth to Vancouver's new and then independent TV station, CKVU, I saw that what was promised on paper by private broadcasters was seldom observed in fact. I discovered that even public television, the CBC, had abandoned earlier responsibilities to the talent and information and culture of our country, and had increasingly failed to act in that public interest. That as the 80s and 90s unfolded, the CBC was increasingly undermined by actions of government. It seemed that all our media institutions and cultural agencies had fallen under the sway of corporate and commercial interests, that the mind and management of these institutions was overwhelmingly centralized, far from our city, centralized in Toronto and Ottawa. Vancouver, your town and mine, and my hometown, instead of being one of English Canada's major cities and major program production centers and our country's gateway to the Pacific, had become the boondocks, the end of the line, just another small town. It had become a kind of Red Deer with seawater. It had become a pathetic media colony living on the handouts of bureaucrats and executives far away. And all the media hype about Vancouver being Hollywood North, with millions and millions of U.S. productions coming in each year, could not hide the fact that our creative people were being handed crumbs by our own institutions, and that they and the citizens they might speak to were together being reduced to being exiles in our own city. Today in English Canada, particularly in Vancouver, we have become like the citizens of so many countries I saw over the years. We may know what we see on our TV screens, we simply don't know what we don't see. And 50 years later, we are still an unknown country. We may know our geography a little better than when I left UBC, but we do not know our people. Our TV screens mirror a white world of U.S. and Toronto-based shows that strip away the rich ethnic and cultural mix of this country. The vivid programming of this world and of our varied and distinct people has been simply stripped from our screens and replaced by the Jerry Springer Show, by Politically Incorrect, and the CBC's Disney-like dramas from the East, such as Wind at My Back and The Road to Avonlea. This failure to redefine English Canada as the years have gone on and as our population has changed and grown affects each and every citizen each and every day. And without wishing to diminish in any way the rights that were deservedly gained by the French language over those years and that were made firm in the Official Languages Act of 1971, I can only regard in program terms, not in social terms, but in program terms in English Canada, that had the result of being a kind of preemptive strike, keeping us forever locked in a simplistic and cultural backwater. It is what gives the okay to the CRTC to hold the notion that it is acceptable that Toronto speaks for English Canada, and it gives permission to private broadcasters that they can freely stuff their schedules full of U.S. programming, because as we're told over and over again, English Canada has no culture anyway. English Canada, to my mind, and my whole point tonight is that it should now redefine itself and must redefine itself if it is to keep alive and to keep champagne bubbles in its bloodstream. It should redefine itself as a multilingual, not a bilingual one. And the notion of two founding nations is maybe simply a break on our imaginations and in cultural and ethnic terms, when now millions and millions of people from all over the world have for years helped build our society. Every day in the newspapers, we are urged to go global. Yet we have a global population here at home we make no use of. Those cultures and their rich heritages of literature, filmmaking, religion, music, and economic activity with ties worldwide must be reflected in our programming and filmmaking. And the sight of Jean Chrétien and his gaggle of Team Canada businessmen stumbling around the countries of Asia and South America, knowing nothing about the cultures and languages of the countries they visit, makes one say, thank God for Herb Dollarwell and Raymond Chan. We must rejoin the world and remember its main languages are English and Chinese, Hindi, Spanish, and Russian, with Arabic coming up in sixth position. For this new Pacific society to really get at the programming we need to get at, we need to remember that our students and our young people should be taking immersion Mandarin, immersion Spanish, immersion Japanese, or Hindi, and all, and those that changes of thinking would make the most sense. Our programming must come to a familiarity that our world no longer looks solely east, but westward out across the Pacific. Now, when we pick up the remote control and punch up our TV sets, it is time to insist our public and our private broadcasters do more than hire an ethnic news anchor to say they cover Canada's West Coast diversity. For the CBC, it is time its programming, its staff, its management, and the appointments to its board of directors reflect the Canada which pays the taxes. The centralization of our institutions and our programming in Toronto and Ottawa, the cutting off of our drama, music, news, and documentary from the rich sources of China, Japan, India, the Philippines, Vietnam, as well as the Middle East and South America, leaves us all bereft. For in those countries, such as China and in Vietnam, are some of the best fiction writing going on today, as well as in South America. I know in this exciting Pacific city, which I am still very proud to call my hometown, there is new programming to be done. The English Canada of my great-grandparents is gone. Even the English Canada which existed when I went here to UBC has gone. Now, multicultural Canada is no fanciful daydream. To walk the shops and malls of the Pacific Centre or Oak Ridge or Richmond is to witness a totally new Canada. To change subways in Toronto at Bloor and Yonge is to witness a totally new Canada. A few statistics might bring this home. About 31% of the Vancouver School District has a Chinese language, Mandarin or Cantonese, as a home language. In the same school district, up to 45% of the homes have an Asian language spoken in it. Hundreds of thousands of new Canadians are here and in Toronto, from Central and South America and the Middle East. The numbers of Buddhists and Muslims in Canada climbs daily. In Surrey, Punjabi is the second language. North and West Vancouver are home to North America's second largest Iranian community. Yet where are any of these peoples or their cultures and their literature and rich heritage celebrated on the CBC or in any of our private broadcasters? It is time that we change the look of our TV screens to the new Canada that we all proudly possess. Now, I want to put on this machinery here and show you some of the program schedules of what the Canadian stations, public and private, licensed to serve the citizens of Vancouver, actually bring us week in, week out. And I will show you, and I will first show you the 1990 weekly program schedules, which are color-coded as to Canadian, U.S., and foreign programming. And then we'll look at various program material for this year put out by our so-called Vancouver stations. Now, let me do this, and we'll put on the Vancouver, the winter 99, 7 to 11 p.m. Now, the red up at the top, that's CBC at the top. And you think, oh boy, they're doing terrifically. It's all red. All the red shows are Canadian, as you can see from the color coding at the bottom. Now, the red shows are all Canadian, but I think you'll have a hard job finding a Vancouver show in there. Somehow, the Vancouver viewer is excluded from that most precious of the evening hours, prime time or peak time, between 7 and 11. Now, if you go to Chan or Czech or VTV or CKVU, the white is U.S. programming. And as you see, what we're all getting are endless U.S. shows, reruns of Fraser and Friends, and some Canadian shows which you think, well, that'll do us some good, and you find it's Stargate 1, it's Once a Thief, it's Police Academy, and it's FX, the series. In other words, more commercial dramas that could have been made on either side of the border. Now, I'd like to just go now to the same evening, but extend the time period between 5 p.m. to midnight. And you perhaps will see the very cynical thing that's happened. Suddenly, Vancouver enters the picture. Peak periods when all of you are at home, but now at the beginning and ends of the evening, there's local news and sports stripped along each day of the week. And that's how Vancouver knows itself and sees itself. So that where prime time or peak viewing is, and where most people are at home from work, there's very little opportunity to see other than on news at 6 to 7 or from 11 to midnight. And I find this schedules, and I'll put on the next stations, I find it cynical in the extreme to for stations, both public and private, to so cynically cover their obligations in this way, that there's VTV with live news at 6 and then news at 11. There's Czech in Victoria with news and then nothing further for the rest of the evening. Now, I am not going to analyze each of those shows, but just to say the white is U.S. and most of the red are commercial dramas made in Toronto or made here, but having little application to any of our lives. And then there's the news. And to my mind, the news is the lowest form of broadcasting. It is, to me, the new pornography. Because just as pornography brings us images of sex without love, so news brings us images of information without understanding. And news is the most easily controlled, requires the least long-term investment in people or script development or research, and it can take, for the most part, minimum wage people fresh from BCIT or Ryerson and put them out to work, and they can come and go at the owner's pleasure. So that I point out that all these shows, also these U.S. shows, they're already available from Seattle. So what have we done? We have covered our own Canadian stations with U.S. shows and given broadcasters the valuable gift of what's called Bill C-58, which allows Canadian stations to simulcast these shows with Seattle, get the total rating points that both stations would have, and then charge enormously. But the gift was not repaid to the Canadian people in kind. And that wonderful benefit, as you can just see, for that wonderful benefit, the Canadian viewer, and the Vancouver viewer in particular, was kicked out of peak viewing hours. Now, I turn away from those schedules, really, in a kind of disgust, because this has been a business I've been in all my life, and I hate to see us coming to that kind of cynicism. But this is cultural clear-cutting of the worst kind. To me, we had to take action to save our forests, and even our young people had to chain themselves to trees when government licensing procedures and logging companies did not regard responsibly our forests. And many people, both old and young, had to run the risk of being in contempt and even having prison sentences to save forests and save Clay-Cut Sound. People have had to take extreme action to say, what is happening to our salmon? And the streams were not protected. The forests and runoffs and spawning areas were not protected. Today, there is a tremendous debate in the papers and everywhere with all people about the kind of health care system that all of us are going to have in this country in a year or 2 years or 5 years' time. And in a way that this is as serious to my mind as what is happening to our forests or our fish, because this is the territory of our minds and our futures and our sense of who we are as a society. But what kind of compliant regulator is the CRTC, which allows this? And I can only really be rather kind of bitchy and say, is it because its members and its head are appointed in secret without public hearing by the Prime Minister that we tolerate, that a CRTC like this tolerates our access to our media to be so easily stripped away? And what kind of rubber stamp is the CRTC to allow such a concentration of ownership where all our broadcast assets are in the hands of a few middle-aged men in central Canada? Now, there are, somewhere I've got a list of a government release of all the ownership, and I couldn't stop to go, but here is CTV. Here are the corporate holdings of CTV, of some 26 stations, specialty channels, and control of the CTV network and broadcast stations. Here is Canwest, 100% owned by the Asper Corporation and the Asper Family Trust. And we have specialty channels and audiences held captive across the country. Here is Rogers Communications, 71% owned by Ted Rogers, and he controls not only on-air stations but multicultural stations and community stations. Now, he can take on any amount of bank debt. Say that he doesn't have money for programming. He can make deals with the American telecommunications giant AT&T. And he can make deals with British Telecom, all at his own pleasure. He can watch his share price climb, pay himself $1,906,000, as he did in 1998, and keep many of his workers, as some of you may be out in Metro Town or in North Van or somewhere, keep many of his workers either toiling for minimum wage or working as volunteers. And I was on a show for Rogers not long ago, and the makeup lady, a lady in her 40s, had worked for years as a volunteer. And I said, why are you doing that? She said, oh, I'm told I'll get a job in the industry if I work as a volunteer. And I wondered what Ted Rogers' share price was doing that day. But the same can be said for the leaders of Canwest Global, CTV, and other private empires. In 1998, Ivan Fitzan received a compensation package of $8,950,000. Dollars, while his staff at his new VTV station worked at rock-bottom wages or for nothing at all, as interns. And the company went to the taxpayer to get funding for the shows it had promised to do to the CRTC, sometimes up to 70 and 80%, so that you and I paid for those shows while salaries like that were being offered. Now, the same can apply. Izzy Asper of Canwest Global received that same year a salary of $2.7 million while holding 100% control of the company that does almost no Canadian production. And he can control stations from Vancouver and across the country as well as specialty channels. This is not Canadian broadcasting, ladies and gentlemen. To my mind, it is a media coup. In the process of John Chrétien's Ottawa-dominated appointment procedures, and I can't disblame John Chrétien, this has gone on with previous prime ministers, but those Ottawa-dominated appointment procedures, done in secret without public hearings, we virtually lost the control of our airtime. We must ask ourselves, are these kind of U.S.-dominated program schedules what we really want from the airways which belong to all of us? Now, when I filmed in Egypt, there were some villagers in the Nile Delta who would not want me to take their picture for fear I would steal their soul. I wonder what is stolen when strangers come into our midst and set up a TV station. Let me emphasize that these matters have nothing to do with the internet, with email, with chat rooms, nor with giant mergers we read about. AOL has taken over Time Warner. Time Warner has taken over EMI, and so forth. Nor do any of these concerns change because there's a 100-channel universe or a 500-channel one available at the touch of your remote control. Nor does it have anything to do with everyone's natural desire to watch ER or the Super Bowl or who wants to be a millionaire or sit up at all hours to catch the America's Cup from New Zealand. Such shows are part of the bounty of this world, and we should all enjoy them. But what this has to do with is access to our own airtime and the autonomy of decision-making over the airtime that should be ours. It has to do with the quality of our democracy. It has to do with the long-term support for our ideals as well as for our talent. Proper support for the people, the writers, directors, and producers who are our eyes and ears and the temperaments through which we see our world. Not filtered by temperaments far from our shores. English Canada is not a monolith, and Vancouver and its citizens should not be treated as just another bunch of interchangeable consumers. Do we really need Izzy Asper to have a TV license to bring us a Jerry Springer show, which comes in from Seattle anyway? Do we need Yvonne Fitzsan to receive millions in order to receive endless reruns of Fraser? Or the late night Politically Incorrect and 6 hours of basketball just because there's a national franchise here in town and he can call it Canadian? This wonderfully expressive medium must be kept open for our use, open despite all the corporate agendas and government trade deals to contribute to and mirror our lives and to aid us in enhancing what Canadian author John Ralston Saul calls a citizen-based democracy. When it comes to the CBC and CBC Vancouver, the questions are every bit as serious as those which can be leveled at the private broadcasters. After all, this public network is ours, and its actions must be held to the highest standard. I've been on the Friends of Canadian Broadcasting Steering Committee for years, and we have done every month possible, we have done and spoken publicly to defend the CBC. But there are times when one must take exception to it. The CBC is there to establish value, and we must ask, is it establishing value, or is it engaging in the culture of complicity? Edward Said, the Columbia professor who writes on culture, defines the intellectual as someone who stands apart from government and business. Certainly on this score, the CBC has lost its intellectual position. Listen to how Robert McChesney defines public broadcasting. McChesney is a professor at the University of Wisconsin and the author of many books on broadcasting. He says, and all who care for the CBC, please note, and I quote, "By public broadcasting, I mean a system that is non-profit and non-commercial, supported by public funds, ultimately accountable in some legally defined way to the citizenry, aimed at providing a service to the entire population, and one which does not apply commercial principles as the primary means to determine its programming," unquote. What does our poor, pathetic CBC do these days but apply commercial principles to almost every aspect of its program schedule? So deep have been the cuts by the government that the CBC now requires some $465 million a year in commercial revenue. Sales considerations impact almost every decision. The government must be lobbied to restore the funds yanked from the CBC so that this public corporation's independence can be reinstated. And as for providing a service to the entire population, the CRTC has not challenged the CBC, nor has the CBC president, nor its board of directors answered the question, at what point does eliminating the richness of our cultural heritage become censorship? Or the lack of innovation in programming become knowledge suppression? Or the persistent exclusion of large segments of our people betray a serious and deep-seated racism? The CBC has indulged in cultural clear-cutting every bit as damaging as the swath of destruction the most determined logger has perpetrated on our mountainsides. CBC Vancouver doesn't have one interviewer or one interview show in prime time like Charlie Rose on PBS. Not one. The author that I've just started to read, Jonathan Raban, has a marvelous book out about the inside passage through our waters to Alaska called Passage to Juneau. What could be more important than to have Raban with his thick texture of knowledge about our past and our present on our coast on for the Vancouver viewer? We don't need to be spending money running a cooking show when there's already a cooking channel. We don't need a gardening show when there's already a gardening channel. Passage to Juneau or Vancouver poet Robert Bringhurst's book on the Haida language of the Queen Charlotte's are important themes to engage our imaginations. So is the destruction of the salmon. Why no show on the Aboriginal prayers and songs written to the salmon? But then we have no Charlie Rose, and we have no time period. Ladies and gentlemen, these matters must be objected to and changed. When famed singer Lois Marshall, where was the variety show which honored this emotional evening and gave everyone in British Columbia and across Canada a chance to participate and see this evening, not just those who crowd into the Orpheum Theater? Or when India a year ago celebrated its 50th anniversary of independence, where was the major program of documentary, drama, and music honoring this important event? This country has produced some of the finest literature, films, and has contended with some of the most horrific social problems, and has the most interesting mix of democratic and demagogic kinds of events going on, and yet it had one cameraman with a beta cam filing two or three news stories. That's not good enough. On the death of Jack Shadbolt, a giant among Vancouver and Canadian painters, there was no CBC program which defined his career. The memorial service of Haida carver Bill Reid was broadcast on cable, not on the CBC. These omissions from our cultural and spiritual life are not right. As U.S. President Bill Clinton said last week in a State of the Union address, quote, we should do more than tolerate our diversity. We should honor and celebrate it. In Vancouver, the Go Ballet has for 2 years mounted productions and trained exquisite dancers such as Chan Hun Go, Francis Chung, and Sarawani Tanatanath. None have ever danced or been near a CBC studio. Ballet BC, which many people and the taxpayers of Canada help support, it has not had a production on CBC television. The Royal Winnipeg Ballet, the National Ballet, and Les Ballets Canadiens are unseen on today's CBC. In drama, we live without our actors ever seen in a major Shakespeare role, an Arthur Miller play, or a David Hare play. Gone as well are the cutting original works of our own playwrights. We are told that Canadians cannot do political drama, just the British. But I think of marvelous women prose writers, Canadian prose writers, such as Stevie Cameron with her On the Take or Blue Trust, or Marcy MacDonald's portrait of Brian Mulroney in Yankee Doodle Dandy. Who says we couldn't do political drama? And if you think Canadian actors get plenty of opportunity performing in American TV shows shot up here, just try to recall the names of the Canadian actors who appeared in MacGyver or even the recent X-Files. You remember Bruno Gerussi from The Beachcombers, but these other roles are gone and their actors' names forgotten like so much cigarette smoke in the wind. Our symphony orchestras may perform in our concert halls, but they are no longer seen on our TV screens. Thanks to some mighty cloud of joy in CBC management, these orchestras have been exiled to FM radio. Thanks to such tactics, our children and our grandchildren will surely come to think of spectacle as merely the halftime ceremony of the Super Bowl or the retirement party for Wayne Gretzky. I go on at this length and in this detail because for me, content has been my life and content is king. Content needs to be redefined, allowed to explode and stir us if we are going to keep a sense of ourselves and of the excitement and future of this specific city. If we do not get access to our airtime and control and change this kind of content, which government and business have foisted on us, then I think we will surely be just a bunch of lost souls wandering through a universe of American channels looking for a home. The unknown country will be forever truly lost, and John Grierson's popular statement that through information we are made better will be nothing more than a far-off cry for help, a plea for what might have been. Without change, there will be no rescue from the overwhelming influence of U.S. entertainment. We urgently need a CBC devoted to programming other than sports, commercial drama, and mainstream news. Where on the CBC are the dramas based on the literature of Asia, or the Middle East, or South America? Where the specials of Latino music from Cuba or New York, or the celebrations of Carnival from Rio? Where the stars of the Arab world? Or the people like Khaled and other Rai artists from Algiers? Where are the adaptations of Naguib Mahfouz of Egypt, who won a Nobel Prize, or Pramuja and Ataturk of Indonesia, who wrote a magnificent quartet while he was in Suharto's prisons for 10 years. Where are the stars of Hong Kong's music scene, or the vast riches of India's music, or the heart-rending songs of Haris Alexiou of Greece? I say, ladies and gentlemen, that we are dying of malnutrition, and we must somehow reclaim our own airtime and the subject matter of our lives. We have a vibrant, interesting, and global population, and we must bestir ourselves from the degraded and derivative content we are being fed from afar. Listen to David White in the New York Times on the new cultural scene in Europe. I quote, "Welcome to Eurostroika," he writes. "Meet the Euro kids of Belgian dance and experimental theater exploding out of nowhere in the early 80s, deconstructing everything in their paths, the pan-European hip-hop scene of second-generation immigrants in France, Germany, England, and the Netherlands that has become a potent language of inclusion. Meet Asian dub and Bhangra in the dance clubs of London, North African raw music in the production in Paris, and Cape Verdean voices at the top of the music charts. This time of Europe's national artists are Portuguese and Swiss choreographers at home in Germany, Moroccan and Turkish songwriters in Amsterdam and Berlin, African, Japanese, and Vietnamese writers and directors in England and France. Serbs, Croats, and Muslims are Europe's new gypsies, and all the while Dutch producers are organizing everywhere, cultural traders in the manner of their merchant forebears. This is what we need, ladies and gentlemen, this excitement. We're boring ourselves to death. These energies, this explosion of artistic and creative forces could be ours, ladies and gentlemen, for we have the talent and the mix of peoples. But the long torpor of the Canadian broadcaster's prison farm has settled over us as media moguls from afar control our airtime and our own public television. The CBC is betrayed by the lack of vision of its leaders. Somehow, we must reclaim our own time, our own airtime, and we must redefine our own country. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Mr. Duke hasn't lost his voice yet. He'll take some questions. Dr. Clark.
I'd like to ask, what can we, looking ahead, expect of our newspapers? My impression is that they are, in comparison with other media, of somewhat declining interest. And to follow that up, ask, what do you advocate should be done with regard to the newspapers?
Well, I wish I was the expert that your question would like to make me, and I am not about the newspaper scene. I, like you, however, am concerned about concentration of ownership. I'm concerned about fewer and fewer voices, fewer and fewer individual columnists and writers, fewer and fewer people on foreign stories and foreign shores reporting back to us. I remember a Vancouver Sun, which had many columnists reporting from all over the world as individuals, and the famous Pierre Burton and Alan Fotheringham and Jack Scott and others went everywhere. This taking away of personality and individuality, I think, is a very serious matter, and I think there are fewer and fewer markets and places for writers, columnists, and journalists to be published. And I think it's a very serious thing. What can be done about it? In the newspaper world, I don't know. And I wish I could answer you.
All right. Yeah. You spoke quite wisely about culture. I'd like to discuss for a moment the perspective. They're very proud of their culture. And it's being assailed by the howitzers across the border. I'm talking about the
right.
United States.
You're right.
The use of them.
Yes.
And they're only receiving little pellets from pop guns on the other side of their border. It seems to me that there's a role to be played in the interchange of cultures from Quebec
to the rest of Canada.
And vice versa. We would understand each other much
better.
What is happening down is that the use of power are affecting the Canadians who are blaming the Anglicans.
Well, I agree somewhat with that, and I...
Could you summarize the question for the people?
Oh, the... if I can, and don't let me put words improperly in your mouth, the questioner wanted to know what's my opinion of what is happening also to culture in French Canada as their language is assailed from across the border from the U.S., and that we in English Canada are perhaps not doing everything we can to make an interchange and strengthening that interchange with their culture and ours. And I think, does that fairly... meet your question or voice your question? Well, to my mind, nothing I said tonight really has, would I be in any way negative about the influence and gains made by French culture and French language in Canada. I am concerned about the diminishing or about the impact of some of these moves in Canada and how it has been used against the strength and vitality of Indigenous Canadian, English-Canadian culture. And I think both are threatened, French-Canadian on their side and we in ours. I think that there is more understanding that French Canada needs support, and there's less understanding that English Canada needs the support that we're not really giving it, and we need to be excited about the need to really take action on our own behalf. Because I think people are more ready to say, oh, French Canada is threatened, but I think we're just as threatened because speaking that common language, it has been in those private broadcasters' benefit to dismiss ourselves in English Canada as having no culture and having nothing worth defending. And so increasingly, if you tell a person you have nothing, you can replace those programs, as I had up on the screen, with U.S. Shows, and nobody seems to mind. And one of the dangers I see coming out of Ottawa is that that's what English Canadians want. It's just ER and the Super Bowl, and they don't want anything else. And I maintain that we want a lot of other things, but we've got to defend it and defend it quickly.
All right, the back.
Would you agree that the points that you've made about Vancouver and its disenfranchisement vis-a-vis the centralization of production in Toronto would apply also in Calgary, Edmonton, Regina, Winnipeg, Montreal, Halifax? In other words, the local ambience and the local possibilities largely no longer exist there either.
I would agree totally. I hope I made it clear. I was speaking very much from a Vancouver viewpoint, and I've been corrected at times. I was corrected once by a Toronto writer who said, "Wait a minute! I feel just as colonized in Toronto, and that I've lost my access to airtime too." But certainly, from Halifax to here, this access to our airtime and this control of our medium is threatened right across. Yes. I would agree completely with you that funding has been done with impunity and with deliberation. And just as the move, even though I have many friends in independent production, and I am often one myself, the move out of the broadcast system of the CBC and the dismantling of in-house production has been a technological transfer of expertise and people at every point in Canada. And it is really the privatizing of public money and the privatizing of public responsibility. Yeah. Well, I think that is a very... People at the back need to have it repeated. The questioner wondered what my opinion was when you have services like Fairchild TV broadcasting in Cantonese and Mandarin, and where they will undertake programming such as interviewing the two premier candidates. What my opinion is about those services. To my mind, and I was just on Fairchild a month or so ago, in the august position of being a judge of a beauty contest. my point is that every citizen should have access to its public broadcaster, Chinese, Vietnamese, no matter what. And that the CBC has to redefine itself. Now, if others want to have a pay channel, that is their right, or a commercial channel. But there is a responsibility as tech of the CBC to address taxpayer needs. And I would like to see the awareness of the cultural worlds that inhabit our city and our country come to be part of what is often referred to dismissingly as the mainstream service. And because as I said in my remarks, I feel that there are writers in Vietnam of short stories and novels and things who are absolutely magnificent. There are novelists in China like Zhang Xianliang who's Getting Used to Dying and a couple of other of his books, and Liu Hang, who wrote the screenplay for Judo and has novels out. Some of these should be being brought in for all of us to learn from and experience, and so that every aspect in music and drama, in interview shows, I mentioned Charlie Rose from PBS, there is no reason why we have to kind of put walls between these cultures on a service such as the CBC's. Those walls should come down. Now, if people want to maintain a Fairchild, that is their right. But that does not excuse the CBC, to my mind, from both staffing and at the board of director level and every level and in programming, meeting the new challenge of who actually lives here and who's actually paying their taxes, and coming with tremendous resources of culture and language and literature, coming here and able to contribute, and who are not contributing when they could and are willing to. So I'm very much for seeing that be a network of inclusion, not of exclusion.
All right, sir. Well, you're giving me quite a tall order here tonight. I know the Knowledge Network, I think, needs strengthening and protecting, and as does TVO in Ontario, because those services are very threatened, are under-budgeted,
and have a great impact on our local scene. But I don't think they replace the responsibilities of a national broadcaster under the Broadcast Act. But I think both are very important.
Could you comment about children's television in Canada?
The question you want to know about children's television in Canada, I think it's a very underserved area. I think we should really begin to do put far more money into it. And just as our textbooks from schools, our school children are getting textbooks that are 80%, I think it is now, published by foreign owners, I think we've got to look to our children's programming and types of children's programming and support that area. Well, I think what I put on the screen was a great concern about private TV. I turned from their schedules with disgust. And I think that they are not living up to their responsibilities.
Yes, sir?
I'd like to discuss a little more what we can do to improve the situation. For years, we've had some organizations called the Friends of the CBC. Well, people that have been on the board of that organization, and we've been able to join it. And the technical thing is that we should go to the team for our MDs that are kind of with it. And, hello?
Well, you've given me quite a challenge to answer. I'm also on the steering committee of the Friends of Canadian Broadcasting, and the questioner asked, "What do I think can be done, and should we be lobbying our MPs? And also, what do I think about the new CBC president, Robert Rabinovich?" I think that the Friends of Canadian Broadcasting is a very important organization. I've been with it for, I don't know, 7, 8 years. I think the sad thing is that we're the only advocacy group that now exists in this area, and I think there should be a lot of debate and a lot of information going forward on this area. To me, it's as important as protecting our forests and our salmon and our healthcare system as protecting what control of what's going into our minds and our culture. And what you say about lobbying our MPs, I think is going to need a really aggressive campaign of writing MPs, of writing provincial governments, of writing the CBC. I think you mentioned Robert Rabinovich. He is all too... He came out here, and I was away, but he came to Vancouver and spoke at the Vancouver Playhouse. I think he's too ready to service the needs of his huge and expensive broadcast center in Toronto and use that as an excuse why production must be kept there rather than saying... And looking back to the time when CBC was in 26 different locations in Toronto, and we produced shows here in Vancouver out of a former automobile showroom, and that perhaps some of the shows did not need a vast broadcast center in which hundreds of thousands went down the drain each year in lease fees, so that I think he's got to do some redefining of what makes public broadcasting work in this country, and it is not to have... to my mind, a superstation like Ted Turner has from Atlanta. It is to have citizens involved and citizens able to respond to what they're seeing and citizens' voices, but also with a national broadcaster who can marshal the funding necessary for each area to properly mount its productions. When I, in my remarks, mentioned why wasn't there a 3 or 4 hour special done on the anniversary of the independence of India, that is a would have been a natural production for CBC Vancouver, and yet it would have to have the funds. But CBC Vancouver has no no access to a budget without Toronto's permission, and no access to airtime. And until those things are objected to by each and every one of you, and by all of us taking issue with the way things are run, they're not going to get any better.
Lady on the aisle, towards the back. Have you a question? I'll ask Mr. Duke to comment on what you've said.
Well, I think you're very prescient that there could be, and perhaps when this previous questioner asked about Robert Rabinovich, for all we know, in his taking up the CBC presidency, there might have been an agreement not only to perhaps change the Broadcasting Act, which could happen very quickly, to allow increased foreign ownership with Rogers and CanWest and the rest of them, but change the Broadcasting Act in so far that before we would know it, CBC Vancouver could lose its studios and its transmitters. They could be put out to lease. And with much the same reason that you mentioned, they're not being used, and that it would save a lot of money, and that distribution is difficult, and the cost of distributions are enormous, so we'll just centralize everything and get rid of facilities across the country. And I think you're very, you're very canny with that overview, and all one can do is be alert and alarmed and take action about it, because the other step that was taken is that production in Vancouver is no longer regarded as priority programming, and so it doesn't get the same amount of tax credits and other benefits to the broadcasters that production in Toronto does. I was one of those, and perhaps you were too, who went to the CRTC here last March, and there were 126 Vancouverites appeared, and that's an astounding number. To object to both the leadership of the CBC and to what's happening to local broadcasting. And so that message was heard, but when I was in June in Ottawa to appear before the CRTC at the time of the CBC's license renewal, I began working in Ottawa at the Film Board, but I went there feeling very much that they looked on me as kind of coming from cottage country, that I, you know, BC is a nice place to go if you have an aunt out there or something, but that I was really rather droll and couldn't be taken too seriously. The you know, so that I think that we've got to be very alert. And also, just as a kind of footnote to what we're both saying, I would like to say that the Friends of Canadian Broadcasting has the highest membership of anywhere in Canada in BC and in the Lower Mainland, Victoria, and Vancouver Island. Our membership is the highest. There are 44,000 homes belong to the Friends of Canadian Broadcasting, and the highest membership is out here. So, but it means that everybody must speak, because what you say could well be. And in terms of your first remark that I shouldn't be using the word English Canada, I certainly hoped my meaning was an ironic one, that I didn't mean that literally, that we've got to redefine what is meant. That's the point of the whole exercise. My whole exercise tonight is say we need to redefine what our society is.
This will be the last question. Yes, sir?
Reverting to your comments a few months ago about writing to members of Parliament, I'd like just a very brief answer to this question. Do you really feel that if every one of us in this audience tonight were to sit down tomorrow morning and write a letter to every member of Parliament of Ottawa, it would have the slightest effect on the policy of the CBC?
The questioner wants to know that if all of us here tonight were to write to our MP, would it have the slightest... All the MPs, I'm sorry. All the MPs, would it have the slightest effect? Would, if 400 or 450 letters went east from this group? No, I don't think it would. But he wanted a short answer. But I think it would. If you and all of us were to write the president of the CBC with a copy to Sheila Copps and a copy to the prime minister and a copy to a couple of people and regard it as just the first salvo, but one letter would not do it.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. I'll get this later.
I'll now ask Professor Ray Hall of the Theater Department to thank the speaker.
Well, Darrell, in the 44 years that I've had the pleasure and the privilege of knowing you and working with you, and I've heard versions of this speech over more than 7 or 8 years, I just had a tingle go up my spine with you talking about this great country and what we can do in our own small way to take back the airwaves and reflect our home, our culture, and the people that live here. And thank you. And it may be the first salvo, but I think we have a lot of willing soldiers here in the audience who will keep that fight going, the good fight. Thanks, Darrell.
Thank you. I'll just remind you that there will be tea, coffee, and some other refreshments available in the lobby, and same time, same place next week.